This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Day here on The Exchange. Iowa is one of just two states in the nation that has never elected a woman to Congress or as governor. Today, on the 90th anniversary of women's suffrage, an organization called 50-50 in 2020 is launching a statewide effort to change that. The goal is that by the year 2020, Iowa will have elected females to fill 50% of the Iowa legislature and 50% of the congressional delegation in Washington and the office of the governor. 50-50 in 2020 is the brainchild of my guests in this first half hour. Former State Senator Maggie Tinsman is with us, joining us by phone. Maggie Tinsman, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you very much. Very pleased to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Also joining us in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, former Iowa state lawmaker Jean Lloyd-Jones. Jean Lloyd-Jones, welcome to our program.
Thanks very much, Ben. I'm glad to be here as well.
Jean, let's start with you. How did you get involved with this effort?
Actually, Maggie got me involved in this effort about a year ago. We attended a meeting at the Iowa Women's Foundation where Supreme Court Justice Linda Newman spoke. And following her speech, Maggie looked at me and said, "Jean, we should start a candidate school and teach women how to run." So that was the very beginning. Of course, I said, "Oh, no, I don't have time to do that," and so forth. But then when we realized that it's the 90th anniversary of women's suffrage, we said, you know, we have one more decade before it's a century old. And let's see if we can't elect large numbers of women, enough to really make a difference in the state legislature. And for goodness sakes, let's break that glass ceiling of never having elected a woman to Washington or to govern.
Maggie Tinsman, what are the numbers? We know that no woman elected to Congress or as governor. What are the numbers in the state legislature?
Well, we have about 23% female in the Iowa legislature. I believe there are 9 senators, and there are 26 House members. So we have a ways to go, but we have just begun.
And it's notable too that over half of the registered voters in Iowa are women, 53% according to the numbers that I have.
That's right, which means we have over a million women who are very well qualified, educated women who could absolutely do this job very well.
I want to talk about how you plan to do this in a moment, but first let's talk about the why. What are the various reasons you feel this change needs to happen? Maggie Tinsman, you first, please.
Well, I think it needs to happen, and the momentum is for it happening because a couple of things happened in the last year, both with Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin running nationwide. Women have seen other women truly running. Also, younger women have seen their mothers work outside the home, as well as have seen women be elected officials. So timing is right now. We have a problem of civility in our Congress, as well as our state legislature, and women are very good with being very civil in their politics, as well as being good consensus builders, because they do it in their lives all the time.
So you would say that having significantly more women in Congress or a state legislature would create a more civil political climate merely because the gender was shifted?
Yes, because women have a different leadership style than men, and they both need to be at the table.
Jean Lloyd-Jones, what do you think about that? How does leadership different? Is it different when you put it in the hands of elected women rather than men?
Well, studies have shown that when women are included in what they call critical mass numbers, that is up to at least 30%, the climate does change within the body, the legislative body, the corporate boardroom, whatever it is. And that, as Maggie said, women have a different style. Women are more cooperative, collaborative. They include more people in their decision-making. I think there are a couple of other reasons, and to include more women in the legislative arena. And those are, first, that the issues are different. When women are included, we bring different issues, issues concerning family, children, violence against women, a whole host of issues that some men are interested in, but they're not their top priority. Mm-hmm. And that when women are included, those are included. The second reason is that for young girls and boys, they need to see women in powerful leadership positions so that particularly the girls are able to see themselves as being more active and more taking a leadership role in society.
Mm-hmm. When more women are in office, you think it will change the nature of a legislative body, governing, leadership? Will it change the politics of it? Do you think having more women in a legislature favors either of the main parties, Maggie Tinsman?
I don't think it's one party or the other. It's both parties. We have women who are very good at, let me give you an example. When I was in the Iowa Senate, Fridays, often the Iowa Senate didn't work, but it was interesting. I was there as well as all the women senators. And what were they doing? They were talking to their constituents. They were doing emails with their constituents. They were reading up on the issues. And it didn't make any difference whether they were Republican or Democrat. They were all doing the same thing. Now, yes, the parties influence the priorities of women, but
we're going to get more work for our money, won't we, I guess,
yeah.
Is what you're saying, huh?
Yeah, women work harder.
All right. We want to ask our exchange listeners to join our conversation. What difference would more women in elected office make, do you think? Exchange listeners, 1-866-780-9100, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Why do you think Iowa is only one of two states that has never elected a woman to Congress or as a governor? Is that a coincidence? Something about our state that the way that happened? Does or should gender factor into your decision as a voter? 1-866-780-9100. And let's address that question. Why is Iowa a laggard here? Is it the only other state, Mississippi, I believe?
You're right.
And why is Jean Lloyd-Jones, Iowa, a laggard?
We don't know why Iowa is a laggard. One speculation is that because of the way the state was settled and the agricultural community emphasized the need for women to be in the home, that that might have influenced it. I don't think we really know the answer to that. But I want to add to something Maggie said about the atmosphere in the legislature, and that's one of the reasons that we want to be, this is going to be a bipartisan effort, is that we think no matter what party they're from, women will be able to work together better. Mm-hmm. And our bipartisan approach is to recruit women and train them. One of the elements of this 10-year project is every other year we're going to have an academy called Blueprint for Winning. Mm-hmm. I almost said for women. Blueprint for Winning. And we want to train women of both parties together so that when they get elected and they're in that chamber, they will work together.
Do we, when you're talking about they'll be able to work together better than present, you're talking about the issue of civility, gridlock, I suppose. Do we have other legislative bodies, perhaps, outside of this country that are where women are better represented, where we know that may, in fact, be the case on the ground right now?
Definitely. We are 85th. This country is 85th in the percentage of women that serve as in leadership positions in their national assemblies, parliaments, whatever it is.
And when you think of Margaret Thatcher being the Prime Minister of England, Bella Abzug, Israeli
Golda Meir.
Mm-hmm. Now we have the Chancellor of Germany as a female. The past president of Chile has been a female. And most of these countries have a much larger percentage of females in their legislative body than we do.
But is the question there, are the politics in those countries more collaborative, more civil? Do they get along better because they have women? That's what you're saying, right?
Yes, I think the answer is yes.
Jean Lloyd-Jones?
Well, it's hard to study those things. I don't think that we have definitive studies. However, if you look at the Scandinavian countries, who are all way up towards the top in the percentage of women that they have in their leadership positions, those countries are, notoriously peaceful and making good progress. Norway, for example, is 40% women in its assembly, and it is economically way ahead of many, many countries.
Okay, before you ladies have to go, we want to get a few people in on our conversation. Mary is joining us from Keokuk County. Good afternoon, Mary.
Good afternoon, and I am thrilled with your topic. I am always disappointed in our progressive state, thinking that we are incapable of electing or even going out and recruiting intelligent women. When Bonnie Campbell ran several years ago for governor, I was told by other women that they just didn't feel like Iowa was ready to elect a woman governor. And being a political junkie out here on the farm, I am always... like I said, continually disappointed that we don't have more women in office, and I'm proud of our lieutenant governor. I've known her for years, and she's one of the few women I know who has been a leader in this movement in Iowa, and ranking in the lowest tier with Mississippi is a shame. I think that it is time that women who are the majority population-wise in Iowa need to stand up and recruit intelligent, progressive women who can get the job done. Could we do any worse than the men, for heaven's sakes? And I thank you.
Mary from Keokuk County, thank you very much.
I'd like to just say to Mary, I'm particularly glad that she is in the rural area, because one of the things we want to do, and we know we have really bright, intelligent women in the rural area, so we want to recruit from the rural area as well as the urban area.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left with you, and we're going to continue with this discussion in the second half hour, but I want to make sure we get the nuts and bolts of how this organization, 50-50 in 2020, plans to achieve that goal. Maggie, can you tell us quickly, how will you get the women into elected office?
Well, first of all, that's why in 2012 is when we're going to have our blueprint for winning. We're going to spend this next year recruiting women, or first making them aware of this initiative, and hoping that the word will spread so that women will even participate in the running, learning to run, which is Carrie Chapman Catt has ready to run, I guess it's called, in May, and they're going to have a session on that at the new leadership school of the University of Iowa. Also has a session to get women interested in running. We want to take them after they're interested, when they're really wanting to be the candidate, and give them extra special skills so that they will win. And that's the whole idea. We also want to mentor them, connect them to their political party, even though we're both issue neutral and nonpartisan. We will also connect them and let them shadow a woman legislator in the Iowa House and Senate, and we'll have to find another state where they can shadow in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Jean Lloyd-Jones, if you have an election, let's say candidate A and candidate B, one is a male, one is a female, should the fact that one candidate is a female, given our statistics, especially here in Iowa, Should the fact that one candidate is female play any role in a voter's decision?
We don't think so. What we want is for there to be no difference. We want people to look at the candidates, decide on the basis of their qualifications and how effective they think they'll be in office, not on the basis of their gender. We want to get beyond gender, but we have to have enough women running that it's not a surprise to see a woman's name on the ballot, and we want that to be the new normal.
Okay, let's get a caller or two in before our halfway point. John is in Cedar Rapids. Welcome to the program, John.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
My question is regarding the fact that many of the local races in Cedar Rapids and other cities are at least nominally nonpartisan. Does that have an effect on how many candidates then get fed into the party system to get elected at the state and at the state level?
Okay,
I'll take my answer off here.
John, local, a question about local elections. Who can answer that? Gene or Maggie?
I don't think it has much effect on that. I think that candidates come from all sorts of different places. Increasingly, it's seen that they're coming from the boardrooms, corporate boardrooms, from other areas. So I don't think the local elections being nonpartisan has any effect on that.
Stephen,
actually, yeah. I think that it helps women to be elected at the local level first, and then they feel more confident about running at the state level as well. So even though they're nonpartisan at the local level, then they realize that when they get into the issues of education and health care and the environment, they will have to choose a particular philosophy in which to go on with mm-hmm. their candidacy.
Stephen Toledo challenges the both of you when he writes, "Isn't it inherently sexist to say that women will get along better than men?" June Lloyd Jones.
Well, I think it is well understood, and many, many studies have shown that women and men approach issues differently and have different styles of persuasion and so on. And the women are, in general, not every woman, are more cooperative. And I think, ironically, it may be that characteristic in women that makes a lot of women choose not to run, because the very act of campaigning is a competition. And that puts
when women are generally more into collaboration.
Right. And I think the whole issue of running a competitive campaign puts some women off. And Maggie and I are both veterans of campaigns. And I must say, when I first started, I didn't enjoy a campaign very much. But, you know, once you get into it, you learn a lot about yourself. It's a great challenge. And you might find out you really do kind of like it.
Inspiring words there from Gene Lloyd Jones.
Maggie. I think Kinsman. I would just add that yes, it does sound like it's sexist. It isn't meant to be sexist. We are not anti-men at all. We're just saying that we really would like women to be equal to men and have a place at the table, and that's why we're emphasizing the initiative that we are.
Okay, let's go to Felice. Is it Felice in Davenport?
Yes.
Hi, Felice. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
We have a couple minutes left. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm so glad to hear Maggie Tinsman again. I was fortunate enough to listen to her speak at one of the ACLU meetings, and her attitude was emphasized there. And I want to add, as a past investigator, I do know that women pay attention to detail, and so there are more women detective and investigators than there are men, simply because of that detail-oriented attitude. And I'm looking forward to, if she has a program, making sure my daughter is a part of it.
Felice in Davenport, thank you for your views. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. And just a couple more minutes. Looking at the current headlines, political news. We have a number of women in the political spotlight nationwide. Sarah Palin, we'll be talking about her in the second half hour. was in Iowa just last Friday to speak at the Ronald Reagan dinner. Christine O'Donnell making a lot of headlines. Sharon Engel in Nevada making a lot of headlines. Three controversial women not sitting on the fence in what they do or what they say. We can say that for sure. What is the impact of their politics on women in politics as a whole, do you think, Jean Lloyd-Jones?
Well, I think these highly visible races are probably good for the whole country and for women. You know, they see these women running and they think, well, I could do that. They galvanize different sectors of the mm-hmm. electorate. And that's a good thing, because for many years we suffered, voter apathy. Nobody wanted to vote for anybody.
Don't they seem, though, the antipathy of a collaborative sense that you're laying out for women as elected officials?
Well, who knows? When they get there, I mean, I've seen among the people that you have named, I have seen already changes in their attitudes and in their statements and their issues. And I think that when they get there, they may find themselves cooperating. You'd be surprised.
Maggie Tinsman, anything to add on that point?
Oh, I'd say that a campaign is not very collaborative at all.
It's combative, huh?
It's a competition, and it's combative, I'd say. But the whole idea is that if we had a lot of women running, actually they wouldn't stand out so much as who's running as they do now. But also, I agree with Jean that once they get into the legislature, wherever they're going, they find that they can't hold their views just as a single individual. They have to know how to compromise, and that's what women usually are very good at.
Okay, let's end here by having you tell us how people can find out more about this campaign. A lot of questions we couldn't ask for time reasons. 50-50 in 2020. How do we find out more, Jean Lloyd-Jones?
They can go to our website at www.50-50in2020.org. No spaces in between. And look at our website, and there's a place there where you can sign up, get involved, make a contribution, find out more about what we're doing.
Okay, very good. Jean Lloyd-Jones. Maggie Tinsman, thank you very much for joining us. Maggie Tinsman.
Yes, thank you very much. I just want to encourage people to please give this initiative your best shot, and I appeal to all of you who are females to please consider running in this state so we can have even a better quality of life.
Maggie Tinsman, thank you very much. Jean Lloyd-Jones, thank you very much for coming into our studio.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. What difference would more women in elected office make? We'll talk about the campaign this fall and the women running against males. When we come back, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day here on The Exchange. And today, on the 90th anniversary of women's suffrage, we're talking about women in politics and the fact that they are underrepresented. Iowa is one of just two states in the nation, the other being Mississippi, that has never elected a woman to Congress or as governor. In the first half hour, we talked with the leaders of an organization called 50-50 in 2020 that today has launched a statewide effort to change that. Now we want to do some analysis of two races this fall in the state that could change Iowa's no women elected in high office status. Also talk about Sarah Palin's visit to Iowa. We want to reach out to you to join our conversation. Exchange listeners, what difference would more women in elected office make? What do you think? What did you think of Sarah Palin's visit to the state last Friday? 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Joining us now, Diane Bystrom. She is director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. Good afternoon to you, Diane.
Good afternoon.
Joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames and in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City, Kelly Thornburg, Iowa New Leadership Coordinator at the University of Iowa. Kelly, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Ben.
And before we do get to looking at a few of the races in Iowa, Sarah Palin's visit, I'd like each of you to give us a brief explanation of what your entities do. What does the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at ISU do, Diane?
Well, basically, like a lot of units at Iowa State University, we have a teaching, research, and service mission. As part of our academic efforts, we have a leadership certificate program in public leadership and community service. We also have a number of leadership initiatives, including leadership institutes, an upcoming leadership retreat for women. Those are college students. And we also have a ready-to-run campaign school. We are partnering with 50/50 in 2020 in alternating years to offer campaign training for women. So since 2007, the CAT Center has been offering a campaign training program for women in the state of Iowa.
Very good. To Kelly Thornburg, the Iowa New Leadership is?
Iowa New Leadership is a program that's going into its fourth year that is housed at the University of Iowa and is run through the Women's Resource and Action Center. And the program is an intensive, nonpartisan, six-day training that really is aimed at engaging women in their post-secondary education in considering and kind of redefining their own version of leadership and really asking them to consider engaging in the public sector, which we define as elected office, nonprofit leadership, or state-level service. And so we really are there to build relationships with the students, support them early on in their process to help them build the skills that they'll need and build relationships that are going to be beneficial to both themselves and the issues that they're interested in advocating for.
Kelly Thornburg and Diane Bystrom, we want to now turn our focus to Sarah Palin's visit last Friday to Iowa, a big draw at the Ronald Reagan dinner in Des Moines, the Iowa Republican Party's biggest fundraiser. The question on many Republicans' minds is whether, of course, she will run for president in 2012. Mm-hmm. Palin fired up the GOP faithful for this midterm election, and one way she did this was to take the media to task, and we want to listen to that.
How do we get out there? How do we get the message out there to the voters? Practical ways. One, we got to raise funds. We've got to knock on doors. We've got to hold the press accountable when you know that they're making things up and telling untruths. We've got to do this together. And by the way, I am the biggest proponent of freedom of the press in this country. Our young men and women in uniform, willing to fight and die for our constitutional rights, including that right to that free press. It's why I am hot on this lamestream media issue. It's why I'm adamant that they tell the truth. How dare anyone disrespect our troops' sacrifice by claiming the right to print and to say anything without a corresponding responsibility to truth? And in this kind of strange, unaccountable day of anyone and everyone getting to claim that they are a journalist, you got to ask yourself, who are they really? When the media uses, say on deep, deep background, anonymous sources, well, to cowardly attack someone, their record, their intentions, first, remember that these sources, if they ever even really exist, first, remember that they are cowards. Usually in some self-preservation mode, striving for personal power. And the journalists perpetuating the problem, the untruths, they are gutless. They erode our faith in this once proud bedrock of our democracy, America's free press.
Sarah Palin at the Ronald Reagan dinner in Des Moines last Friday, an excerpt there where she's taking the media to task. Do Sarah Palin's words represent a rallying cry for you? Or do these words make your blood boil? We want to hear from you, Exchange listeners, this half hour. What 1-866-780-9100, the Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Joining us this half hour, Diane Bystrom and Kelly Thornburg. Kelly, let me go to you first of all. What are your thoughts on this attack on the media? Fair comment? Effective for her political purposes?
I definitely think it's effective. I mean, she's really very strategic about juxtaposing the strong, brave American soldier against the sort of gutless, cowardly journalist. And that image, whether, you know, it's something that people are really cognizant of absorbing, is really, really potent. And she does that very purposefully, as you can tell through the sort of extreme repetition that she uses through the speech.
Without any specifics, we have to say.
Exactly.
She names no news organization. organizations names no specific instances of gutless behavior on the part of journalists. Interesting to note that. Diane Bystrom, your take on this?
Well, I think I have 2 degrees in journalism and a former journalist, so that's how I maybe catch my response in that way. But also I have spent most of my research life studying media coverage of male and female candidates. I would say, first of all, journalists are easy to beat up on. You know, they're kind of like used car salesmen in some ways. It's an easy crowd to beat up on. Certainly Sarah Palin was playing to her crowd. But every study that I've seen, including on the 2008 election, the mainstream media actually holds itself the most accountable. I do agree with this new kind of blog sphere that I think she alludes to, where there's a lot of things in the new media that isn't, that's not held accountable, and basically outright rumors. And that was one of the rumors that started with, her own daughter, and some rumors about her in the campaign that are started in the new media without any substantiation, and then sometimes spill over to the mainstream media in reporting it. So that's the only thing I would really hold the mainstream media accountable, is not checking out where they're getting their sources from, the new media. But by and large, I think mainstream journalists, particularly newspapers, magazines, and also your mainstream television stations, hold themselves fairly accountable.
Diane Bystrom is the director of the Kerry Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. I want to ask you, as you mentioned, a former journalist, has the media been unfair to Sarah Palin?
Our studies did find that the media were unfair to Sarah Palin and also Hillary Clinton in 2008. This was kind of an interesting finding because we've studied, I'm in a group of researchers nationwide that have studied the media coverage of male and female politicians since about the early 1990s. And women did receive very much stereotypical coverage and less coverage than their male opponents during the 90s until about 1998. And then the coverage started getting more equitable for women and men running for governor and also Senate. That changed in 2008, and I've just completed a study of coverage of governors and mayoral candidates from that year, and we found, again, equitable coverage for women gubernatorial candidates in 2008 and also mayoral candidates. We're not done with our Senate data yet, but we're expecting to find the same. So Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin, who got a lot of research in 2008, researchers, every single study I've read, found that both women were treated in sexist and stereotyped ways.
1-866-780-9100 if you'd like to join our conversation. Tom is in Iowa City. Good afternoon, Tom.
Ben, thank you very kindly. I will be as polite as I can. Sarah Palin, to me, delivers her comments in a really shrill, intolerant, narrow-minded way. I think she's personally an opportunist and very self-serving and self-indulgent.
Mm. Tom, okay, from Iowa City. Well, opportunist, that lines up well with many politicians we've had over the years as well. How much of Sarah Palin's appeal comes from the fact that she is a woman? Kelly, can we imagine a man with similar views, sharp rhetoric, capturing this much attention and adulation?
Well, I definitely think that there are certainly men in the media, particularly, Rush Limbaugh is coming at his conversation not necessarily with any background other than really being a radio host, and he certainly is very captivating to his audience. But Sarah Palin, I think, has done a great job integrating feminist principles with assumed sort of more traditional ideas, and really integrated her motherhood into her candidacy with the Mama Grizzly.
Mama Grizzly, right.
What
is the Mama Grizzly anyway? A Mama Grizzly is someone who is very protective, ferocious when necessary.
She used the analogy in her June, her first really slick ad that definitely kind of indicates a presidential run as far as I'm personally concerned. And she uses the analogy that the Mama Grizzly is a perfect example of how American mothers are going to protect their children no matter what, and they'll do anything to do so.
Okay.
So
we want to talk about the Grassley-Conlin race and the Loebsack-Miller-Meeks race, but before that, one more caller on the Palin topic. Joanne in Cedar Rapids, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead. What are your views on Sarah Palin?
She rambles a lot.
She's got interesting speech, doesn't she?
I just can't take her seriously. She's a lot of noise, a lot of rhetoric,
What do you make of the fact that so many people do take her seriously?
I just can't believe it. I really can't believe it. Anybody takes her seriously. I totally agree with the gentleman that was on just before on his comments on her. I listened to her, and I end up thinking, what is she saying? What is she trying to say?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't see any meat there.
Okay, thank you, Joanne in Cedar Rapids. Quickly to Jesse in Sigourney. Hi, Jesse.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I was just going to say that I know, lover or hater, Sarah Palin associates herself, or a lot of American people associate themselves with Sarah Palin, and I think that's why the mainstream media is panicking, Republican and Democrat, because they know that more and more people are going over to her side, and they're going to vote for her. I voted for Obama. I could shoot myself in the foot for that, because I will be voting for Sarah Palin, and you guarantee it, within the next 10 years, she will be VP or president, because more Americans are tired of the mainstream media, which is a mainstream Democrat and mainstream Republican, and they themselves, by trying to be mainstream, are out of the loop, and they need to get back to the values. And Sarah Palin, lover or hater, she's got what people want.
Thank you, Jesse, for that interesting perspective. Jesse from Sigourney. Let's move on to the Charles Grassley and Conlon race long before we run out of time this hour. Longtime incumbent U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley facing challenger Democrat Roxanne Conlon. We wanted to play a couple of ads, juxtapose a couple of ads, and talk about their efficacy. Let's start with the Grassley campaign, what it's going after in this ad.
I heard Chuck Grassley has a Twitter.
Oh, can it be cured?
Oh, not that kind. I like to use new technologies like Twitter and Facebook just to keep in touch. And meetings in 99 counties every year. I'll tweet, I'll text, I'll do whatever it takes. I work for you.
Grassley works for us.
I'm Chuck Grassley, and I approve this message.
Obviously an ad from the Grassley campaign. Diane Bystrom, how effective is that ad for you?
I actually love that ad. I study political advertising and studying it from a kind of a nonpartisan look. I actually just like to look at the ads. I think that that is a clever way for Grassley to deal with the he doesn't talk about it, but it's the issue of his age. Actually, there's a Roxanne Conlon ad that compares him to a Ford Pinto, I believe.
We're going to hear that in just a moment, as a matter of fact.
I actually think it's a clever ad of Grassley, and he is on Twitter, apparently, and he does do some social media. So I think it's an interesting way it uses senior citizens. And I actually think it uses humor, and I think it's a good ad.
Right, and we have to notice here not only the high-tech aspect in sort of a sweet way approaching that. Yes, he has Twitter. But also, aside from Grassley in this ad, we have all female voices.
Yes.
And he has a female opponent. So this is a positive ad, not an attack ad. Kelly, before we move on to the next ad, your reaction to this one?
I think just coming possibly from a different generational perspective, I don't see any people who really, really use any of those technologies as an integrated part of their life buying into that ad. I think it's sweet and sure, he's a nice old Iowa man, and you can tell that in the ad, and that's endearing, but it doesn't make him actually connected to our issues.
Okay. So. Let's listen to another ad. This is from Democrat Roxanne Conlon challenging Chuck Grassley. This is a much different tact on it. Listen, the ad from Democrat Roxanne Conlon's campaign.
The year was 1975. The car was the Ford Pinto. And the Washington politician, Chuck Grassley. After 35 years, Washington sure changed him. He took $800,000 from Wall Street and voted for the Wall Street bank bailout. Even voted five times for tax breaks for companies to ship jobs overseas. Chuck Grassley, after 35 years in Washington, he's lost touch with Iowa.
I'm Roxanne Conlon, and I approve this message.
So definitely on the attack side of ads, Diane Bystrom, how do you think this ad runs?
Again, I think it's a clever ad. It's an ad. I mean, obviously, what you want to do with political advertising, you want it. It's only 30 seconds, most ads are, and you want something that people are going to see and remember. And so I think both of those ads meet that criteria because they play over and over in your head. They're both really kind of dealing with the same issue in a way in which Conlon is now making a point using the 1970s and disco music that, you know, Grassley's out of touch and then backing it up with some specific examples of that. So I think, obviously, it's an attack ad. But again, I think it's done in a clever way. So actually, those are two of my more favorite ads of this cycle in that race.
Okay. But interesting to note here, according to the latest poll from Rasmussen Reports, I think middle of September, Grassley holds a commanding 20 percentage point lead over the opponent, Roxanne Conlon. So a lot of negative ads to come, I would imagine. We can guess that. Let's get quickly to this other race. Iowa's 2nd District Republican Marionette Miller Meeks is challenging incumbent Dave Loebsack. Miller Meeks lost to Loebsack in 2008 by quite a large margin. A recent poll, albeit one commissioned by the National Republican Congressional Committee and the 2nd Congressional District Republican candidate Marionette Miller Meeks campaign, found her within a percentage point of incumbent Democrat Dave Loebsack. Your observations about this race, Kelly Thornburg.
I think Marionette is a really hard worker, and I think that that's really paying off for her, just in terms of using all of her resources. You can see her everywhere, and I don't necessarily see that as much with Dave, and I think that does make an impact. I mean, people know that she's serious and she's really just giving it her all, and that means a lot in Iowa, I think. So,
mm-hmm. And Diane.
Again, I think I agree with Kelly, and she's closer to that race than I am here in the 4th District. But certainly Marionette is a hard worker. I had the pleasure of interviewing both her and Becky Greenwald after 2008. They both ran for Congress that year. And again, both very hard workers, both came out of a kind of a non-traditional background, which actually is now becoming more traditional for women candidates, coming out of more of the business sector than kind of the state legislative pipeline. And so I think Marionette is a very hard worker. I think she's a very enjoyable, likable person to talk to. And I think specifically with that race, it's always difficult. And I think we need to point out to the listeners is that it is extremely difficult for challengers, be they female or male, to beat an incumbent. The incumbents win at more of a 90% rate, both male and female. And so if you're an incumbent, you have a pretty good chance. Senate incumbents tend to win at a higher rate than House incumbents. So House incumbents are a little bit more vulnerable than Senate incumbents. So Grassley's numbers, although they're very large, this is probably the tightest race he's been in for a long time. I think with Loebsack, you know, he was kind of an upset candidate in 2000 and I think it was 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And
against
so,
Jim Leach,
you know, and yeah. He, you know, beat Leach, Jim Leach in that year. So he was kind of came out of the blue. And so, you know, typically those candidates are most vulnerable the next 2 years. And Marionette ran against him in 2008. So I think, first of all, she's got some more name recognition this year. And I think that Loebsack is vulnerable because he hasn't been in the House as long as some of our other representatives.
Diane, is there any research to indicate that a candidate running a second time, as Miller Meeks is doing, is more effective, has a better chance?
Yes, it's basically the name recognition. Sometimes, they encourage, and this is a difference. You know, I know that you were talking earlier in the show about differences between men and women. And some of the things that we have to encourage women to do is sometimes it takes as many as three times running for a political office to get elected, you know, even if you're a male candidate. I mean, you need to have the name recognition. And certainly, I think, you know, she established that, 2 years ago, and so it certainly does help every time you run and get your name out there. It helps in your next race. And so obviously name ID, name recognition is one of the first things that a candidate has to establish. And so if they've run before, that certainly is helpful next time they run.
Not much time left. We want to squeeze in one more caller, Marty from Garner. Marty, very little time. What do you have to say?
Well, I just wanted to say in regards to Sarah Palin that it just floors me that any woman would give her a second thought. You know, we've had such wonderful female candidates for office in Iowa, like Bonnie Campbell and Roxanne Conlon, intelligent women who can actually grasp and articulate issues instead of just that whining, carping Sarah Palin. You know, there's scratch the surface. There's nothing there. And
okay,
I just wish Republicans would come up with more intelligent candidates.
Okay, Marty, we'll have to get you together for a debate with Jesse in Sigourney we had earlier on the program. I want to thank our guest for this half hour, Diane Bystrom, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University, Kelly Thornburg, Iowa New Leadership Coordinator at the University of Iowa. Kelly, Diane, thank you so much for joining us this half hour.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
And The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, we had help from Michael Yeager. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available. Perhaps you heard a portion of this hour. Want to hear the entire hour? go to iowapublicradio.org. We always love your comments and questions about this program. You can write us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much for joining us.